Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, the 2017 congressional delegation had its official swearing in. Congress is open for business, and the leadership wasted no time getting down to the business of voting to repeal the Affordable Care Act as promised.
Republican Senator Mike Enzi of Wyoming introduced a resolution just hours after the new Congress convened that will serve as the vehicle to try and repeal much of President Obama's signature health care law.
Republicans have to use a budget resolution to undo the Affordable Care Act, so lawmakers will be able to repeal the parts of the law that have budget and tax implications.
Essentially, they get to gut the law without fully repealing the entire piece of legislation by removing all the subsidies that are in place to help low and middle income people buy health insurance.
But in the meantime, there are still many legal and legislative questions that need answering. So we invited today's guest, Professor Timothy Jost, to weigh in with us.
Professor Jost is the Emeritus Professor of Law at Washington and Lee University School of Law. He's a frequent contributor to health affairs and really one of the nation's leading scholars on health law and health policy.
Lori Robertson also weighs in, the managing editor of factcheck.org, always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter because we love hearing from you. We'll get to our interview with Timothy Jost in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. As promised, the newly sworn-in Republican-controlled Congress ushered in their vision of the future by introducing a bill to repeal the Affordable Care Act. The so-called American Health Care Reform Act of 2017 seeks to establish state-based high-risk pools, increase health savings accounts, and allow insurance sales across state lines. The bill was sponsored by the conservative Republican Study Committee to, quote, wrest health care out of the hands of bureaucrats. There are other replace measures emerging from different camps within the GOP, some from an extreme of repealing the ACA and replacing it with almost nothing. Other plans from conservative think tanks suggest it would be better to keep Obamacare intact and replace portions of the law that aren't working. One thing the plans all share in common, the poor are looking at significant loss of coverage and therefore loss of access to health care. One way millions of the nation's poor gain access to health care is through Planned Parenthood. House Speaker Paul Ryan has put forth a bill that will eliminate hundreds of millions of dollars in funding. Ryan saying the defunding would be fast-tracked and go through as soon as next month. Millions of poor Americans gain a wide degree of health services through Planned Parenthood's clinics, including regular preventive care, cancer screenings, and STD screening and treatment. Meanwhile, members of the Congressional Democratic minority are pushing back on a number of points, asking the Independent Congressional Ethics Committee to look into allegations of HHS Secretary nominee Tom Price, who they say profited off legislation he pushed through Congress. The Wall Street Journal last month reported Price bought and sold more than $300,000 in stock in about 40 healthcare, pharmaceutical, and biomedical companies, all the while sponsoring and advocating legislation that could influence those companies' shares. In a major health recommendation reversal, the National Institutes of Health is giving the okay for parents of young babies to start introducing peanuts into their diets to stave off the onset of deadly peanut allergies. Studies show low doses of peanut exposure at a very early age can actually prevent the onset of deadly peanut allergies, which have seen a dramatic rise in recent decades. Studies show the best time to expose children to allergens is when their immune systems aren't fully formed, which takes a few years, suggesting introducing small amounts of peanut butter into the diets of babies as young as 4 to 6 months old, as long as they're eating other solid foods. So, want to keep your little peanut allergy free? Try peanut dosing during their first year of life. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Timothy Jost, Emeritus Professor of Law at the Washington and Lee University School of Law, prolific writer. He's author of Health Law, a casebook used widely at many U.S. law schools. Professor Jost is a frequent blogger for the renowned journal Health Affairs. Professor Joist is an elected member of the National Academy of Medicine in the American Society of Law and Medicine. He earned his JD with honors from the University of Chicago. Welcome back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
In a recent health affairs blog, you noted that in wake of the 2016 election, Obamacare is facing a far more dramatic threat. And I'm wondering if you could help our listeners understand the crossroads where we stand right now.
Yes, the Republican leadership in Congress introduced a budget resolution in the Senate that would open the way for repealing many of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act through a simple majority vote. Through the budget reconciliation process, Congress can move forward with making major changes in laws, and in particular laws that affect the revenues or outlays of the United States government, without having to worry about a filibuster. And so with the 52 votes that the Republicans have in the Senate and the overwhelming majority in the House, they could move forward with repeal of the Affordable Care Act. The Republican Study Committee, a group of conservative Republicans, introduced legislation that would take the country in a radically different way in terms of health care access. The Republicans have not come together yet on any concrete suggestion for replacing the Affordable Care Act or for dealing with the 20 to 30 million Americans who would lose coverage through repeal. So I think we're heading into a very dangerous time for low and moderate income Americans who do not have coverage through their employers, and also for Americans with pre-existing conditions.
Professor Joist, it does feel like deja vu all over again. You know, back in 2009, we had House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on the show. She was one of the legislation's chief architects, and she took a tremendous amount of heat from her GOP opponents at the time by saying publicly, well, sometimes you have to pass laws without being entirely sure what's in them. But it seems like the same thing is coming to pass with this repeal and replace agenda. Very few details are clear about what the replace legislation will look like or when it will happen. So what elements of the law can actually be repealed legislatively, as you said, with the budget reconciliation, but what aspects of the law might prove much harder to dismantle?
Well, it's ironic that what Nancy Pelosi actually meant, and she has been very, very widely misquoted on this, was that once we passed the legislation, the American people would realize all of the good things that were in the legislation. And what is actually happening now is that we're in a very different situation where, in fact, we do not know and cannot know what will be in the replaced legislation because there is no single proposal yet to replace the Affordable Care Act. The Republicans are nowhere close to coming together. The budget reconciliation process is a process through which Congress could address things like the premium tax credits, the Medicaid expansions, the individual and employer mandates. It probably could not address things like the guaranteed issue and guaranteed renewal, the ban on health status underwriting, the ban on gender underwriting, which is very important. Before the Affordable Care Act, women almost universally paid more than men for health coverage. It could not address the ban on pre-existing condition exclusions. So any kind of repeal and replace based on budget reconciliation is going to have a lot of holes in it and probably won't work very well. You can't have a ban on pre-existing condition exclusions that will work if you don't have the premium tax credits and something like the individual mandate. What the Republicans are talking about now is what would be called repeal and delay, where they would repeal key provisions at this point and then just say, let's wait a couple of years before we get rid of the premium tax credits, maybe the Medicaid expansion, and see if we can think of something to replace it with. The problem with that is that insurers are not charities and might very well not stick around for a couple of years to find out what the Republicans come up with. So I think we're faced with the potential crash of not just the marketplaces, but the entire individual market, leaving 20 million people without any way of getting health insurance coverage.
Let's look at some of the gains under Obamacare. And you've noted that it's not only the 20 million plus uninsured people that have gained access. You have some longitudinal data on other gains that have been made. I'm wondering if you can help us understand what some of those gains are that the typical health consumer might not be aware of.
Sure. And I think everybody knows by this point that the levels of the uninsured, our rates are now at the lowest levels in history. But many of your listeners may not know that improvements in hospital care leading to fewer hospital-acquired infections have saved about 125,000 lives since the ACA was adopted, and expanded coverage is preventing about 24,000 deaths a year. National health expenditures over the 2010 to 2019 period are projected to be $2.6 trillion less than the expenditures that were projected just before the ACA became law. Coverage has risen for children, young adults, and all age levels, all income levels, all ethnic and racial groups. And expanded coverage has also resulted in improved access to care, with a share of Americans who report not having received medical care due to cost dropping by one-third since 2010. The burden of uncompensated care borne by hospitals has declined by about one-quarter since 2013. The ACA has also helped people with employee coverage, which is the majority of Americans. The number of employees with an annual cap on their out-of-pocket costs has increased by 22 million since the ACA has been adopted. Growth in per-employee costs of employer-based coverage has fallen to 5.6% from the decade before the ACA annual growth to 3.1% since the ACA was adopted. And private sector employment has grown continuously since the ACA was adopted, and the fall in the uninsured rate has not negatively influenced job growth, as some had predicted. So there's just been a lot of improvements in quality of care, in reduction of the cost of care, as well as the dramatic gains in access.
Well, we recently had Sarah Collins from the Commonwealth Fund on the show, and she was outlining some of the dramatic setbacks that could occur if the repeal goes through, as has been proposed by the GOP leaders, and she quoted studies that also show the repeal of Obamacare leading to more uninsured Americans even than there were prior to the law's passage. But she makes the point that the low-income, vulnerable Americans are the most at risk in the wake of a repeal. Why is it going to target them particularly, and what's the role that Medicaid plays in all of this?
The Medicaid expansions have been very important in expanding coverage to millions of Americans who previously lacked access to health care, and played a very important role in bringing down the uncompensated care burden of hospitals. The Republican Study Committee proposal would replace the tax credit with a tax deduction. Now, if you're not paying taxes, a tax deduction is completely worthless.
Right.
This is just a flat-out transfer of income, transfer of access to health care from low-income Americans to high-income Americans. In addition, repealing the tax increases on Americans earning more than $200,000 a year under the Affordable Care Act would result in literally hundreds of billions of dollars of tax cuts for high-income Americans over 10 years. Even fixed-dollar tax credits would be essentially worthless to low-income Americans because they either would not provide enough money to purchase a health insurance policy, or they would only cover a very, very high deductible health insurance policy. I think a lot of people don't realize, however, how many other things were in the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
I mean, there were loan and grant programs mm-hmm. for people trying to pursue an education mm-hmm. in health care. There was expanded funding for community public health institutions. Of course, closing the donut hole for seniors on Medicare. So there is a lot in the Affordable Care Act, if it were repealed as a whole, that Americans may never have noticed was there, but would certainly notice if it was gone.
We're speaking today with health policy expert Timothy Jost, Emeritus Professor of Law at the Washington and Lee University School of Law, and frequent contributor to the noted publication Health Affairs. You know, we've certainly have alignment on the repeal and replace side. We've got a couple of big cases out there. In 2015, Judge Collier ruled that the House Republicans had standing to sue the executive branch over a spending dispute, and the Obamacare administration had been distributing health subsidies in violation of the Constitution. And what are your thoughts about if that ruling is upheld? Will we start to see lawsuits on the other side as well?
Well, House v. Burwell, I think, is the most immediate threat to the stability of the individual insurance market in the United States. Judge Collier held that several billion dollars that are being paid each year to insurers who are required under the Affordable Care Act to reduce the deductibles and coinsurance and copayments. Judge Collier held that there had been no appropriation for those payments, and thus they had to stop. The Obama administration has been vigorously contesting that. The House recently got a delay in that litigation, claiming that the Trump administration may take a different position and the court should wait until February to find out what the Trump administration's position was. If the Trump administration agrees with the House and withdraws the appeal, I think that could, in very quick order, destroy the individual market in the United States. The individual market isn't that important to many of them. And they may just say, forget it, we're leaving. They certainly wouldn't come back for 2018. We still have the contraceptive cases, and I would expect that we're now going to see possibly dozens of cases filed challenging the Trump administration.
Right. Well, Professor, you talked about the jeopardy of the Medicaid expansion, the potential privatizing of Medicare. What's the political risk when we make the laundry list of all who are likely to be very angry at loss of benefits? We have the denial for pre-existing conditions. We have people literally dying in the streets from opioid overdose, and what coverage there is could easily slip away. Seems like a potential for enormous political risk.
Well, that is an issue of concern. I think polling shows that a lot of the lowest income Americans are simply discouraged, and I think a lot of people also voted for Donald Trump because they really were dissatisfied with the current political situation and wanted a change, but didn't really believe that he was going to get rid of the Affordable Care Act, under which many of them are covered. If you look at the things that the administration is talking about doing in terms of immigration, climate change, judicial appointments, they will affect voters over a long period of time. On the other hand, if you cut off someone's insurance coverage, it's going to be days before they realize what's happened. And so I do think that there could be a tremendous political backlash. It's generally accepted that the Democrats really suffered because of misunderstandings of the Affordable Care Act as much as what the Affordable Care Act actually did. Now the health care system belongs to the Republicans, and they're going to have to take responsibility for all of the things that are going to go wrong.
What do you think there may be some commonality? Because clearly, I think everybody admits that it was an imperfect piece of legislation. Do you think there's any common ground to be found? Chart out for us areas of commonality that might find the light of day.
Well, I think that there are actually substantial grounds for working together bipartisanly. The recently adopted Cures Act, the MACRA Act, which was adopted last year, I think crossed a whole range of issues like investment in healthcare research, in quality improvement, in cost control. I think there is a lot of common ground. Unfortunately, in the area of access to healthcare, actually, I think the country is far less divided than the political parties are. The recent polling showed that only about a quarter of Americans want to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and almost half want to either keep it or expand it. The proposals that we're seeing, I think, would pretty radically shift the focus of access from trying to provide access for the lowest income Americans to trying to improve and expand on the income of the highest income Americans. And I would say that one of the problems of the Affordable Care Act is that it did not do enough for middle income Americans whose income was too high to qualify for the subsidies that it provided. And if a replacement plan provides tax credits for higher income Americans in the individual market, it would probably to some extent help address that issue. But I think a proposal like this Health Republican Study Group that would offer nothing to low-income Americans and a great deal to high-income Americans is not going to get bipartisan support.
Mm-hmm. We've been speaking today with Timothy Jost, Emeritus Professor of Law at the Washington and Lee University School of Law. You can learn more about his work by going to the Health Affairs blog at healthaffairs.org/blog. Professor Jost, thank you so much for joining us again on Conversations on Healthcare.
And thank you very much for inviting me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President-elect Donald Trump claimed that former President Bill Clinton called the Affordable Care Act, quote, crazy, and that Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton said the law, quote, is no longer affordable. Did they really say that? Not exactly. Trump made his claim on Twitter to support his argument that the Affordable Care Act, quote, doesn't work and provides, quote, lousy health care. He has vowed to repeal and replace the ACA, and the Republican-controlled Congress has already taken a step toward repeal. As for Clinton calling the ACA crazy, the former president made those comments while campaigning for his wife, but the fuller context shows he wasn't calling the entire law crazy, and he was blaming Republicans for refusing to make changes to improve it. Clinton said that it was, quote, the craziest thing in the world that those who buy their own insurance but make too much to get subsidies were facing escalating premiums on the individual market. He went on to say that his wife, Hillary, supported allowing those people to buy into Medicare and Medicaid as a way to fix the problem. Similarly, Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton called proposed individual market rate increases in his state, quote, severe, and said, quote, the reality is the Affordable Care Act is no longer affordable to increasing numbers of people. Dayton went on to blame a, quote, totally deadlocked Congress for failing to make, quote, necessary changes or improvements. So Trump leaves out key context from both Clinton's and Dayton's remarks to make his point. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. When longtime IBM executive Sharon Lindor left the corporate world, she thought she would ease into semi-retirement. But then breast cancer diagnoses for her mother and two sisters shifted her focus. She watched as all three of them went through multiple surgeries and treatments, wearing the ubiquitous Johnny, the hospital gowns that tie in the back and leave patients often feeling vulnerable and exposed during time when they are also scared and uncomfortable during their treatments.
The hospital gown was never meant to close in the back. It was meant to make it easy for you to go to the John. And so when you put it in the front, it really doesn't close.
The former corporate executive decided that the 1 in 8 women going through breast cancer treatment needed a power suit of their own to navigate this challenging experience. And she launched her own research project into which fabrics and which designs might provide a better alternative to the standard hospital gown, but one that would also be an easy addition to hospital laundering services.
Nonstop. So the fabric we came up with is a waffle weave fabric, but it's a knit. So the feel of it is very much like a cotton cashmere.
She called her invention Jane's, as opposed to Johnny's, creating a gown that thousands of users have called comfortable, stylish, and a vast improvement from their predecessors.
And they fit people in a comforting way. You're totally covered.
And she developed the gown in time for her own cancer diagnosis.
Jane's did give me really a leg up. I think that I felt better about all of my treatments, just feeling like I looked better.
Jane's, a hospital gown designed for enhancing the female patient experience, providing comfort, dignity, easier access during challenging procedures, or just providing an easier experience for newly breastfeeding mothers. Now that's a bright idea. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.